Welcome to IT, under the punny and dedicated ocular talk show on Clubhouse. Here we like to highlight tech innovations, education, and current topics and vision every week. So make sure you have your driver edge in hand and let's get started. My name is Catherine Lewiston. I completed a master's in ophthalmology at Bascom-Palmer Eye Institute. I currently conduct research on drug development for ocular surface therapeutics here. And I'm joined by our talented team doctors, Gagan Kaura, Mike Singh, Ricky Enzor, and Dr. Grayson Armstrong.
This is a Women in Ophthalmology tech series that we are introducing. And let me pass the mic to Mike Singh, as he would love to introduce his first guest.
Our first guest is someone I've been fortunate enough to work with in the past and call a mentor. Dr. Florence Cabreau is an assistant professor in cornea and refractive surgery at the Bascom-Palmer Eye Institute in Miami, Florida, completing her medical school at the University of Toulouse and residency in Guadalupe. Dr. Cabreau went on to complete a cornea fellowship at the Bascom-Palmer Eye Institute. Her work is dynamic and innovative, from advancements in telemedicine with her work on the drone slit lamp to her work on educating trainees in ophthalmology by developing surgical simulation models. Dr. Cabreau is a trailblazer when it comes to ophthalmic technological innovations. Bienvenue, Dr. Cabreau.
Thank you, Mike, for this nice introduction.
With that, I'd go on and introduce our next guest, Dr. Parvoz Pachani from Government Medical College and Hospital in Chandigarh, India. So she has a faculty appointment as a professor of clinical ophthalmology at GMCH. She received her training in glaucoma from Advanced Eye Center at the Postgraduate Institute of Medical Education and Research in Chandigarh, India. Subsequently went on to complete a clinical research fellowship under Dr. George L. Spaeth at Wills Eye Institute in Philadelphia. Her expertise is in glaucoma and neuro-ophthalmology. Her interests include medical and surgical management of glaucoma, novel surgical devices and therapies. And the tech side of it is the telemedicine, informatics, and machine learning applications within ophthalmology and specifically glaucoma. Dr. Pachani's passion for research and ophthalmic education shows in her work. She's authored several peer-reviewed research publications, edited more than 15 books, and authored more than 70 book chapters in the several internationally acclaimed textbooks in ophthalmology, including The Expert Techniques in Ophthalmic Surgery. She serves on the editorial board for several peer-reviewed journals in ophthalmology, including Journal of Glaucoma. And recently, her book, Artificial Intelligence and Ophthalmology, Perks, Perils, and Pitfalls, was published with Springer Nature. And we are excited to hear all about it from her at some point today. Welcome, Dr. Pachani.
Thank you, Gagan, and thank you, Team IT, for having me on board. And I look forward to learning from all of you, in addition to sharing my views and ideas. Thank you.
That being said, let's venture into our first theme for this session. We'd like to discuss your background and your roadmap. Can you tell us a little bit about your journey? How you got started on your path to ophthalmology? Did you have any female mentors or figures when you first started? And tell us about your first project and what you're currently working on. Dr. Cabreau, you'd like to kick us off?
Yeah, sure. My path is a little bit unusual. I was born and raised in France. I did all my training in France, so medical school, residency, as Mike said. When I finished my residency in Paris, I had a cornea fellowship position waiting for me in Paris, but I had to wait a few months to start. So I asked my mentor in Paris, basically, if I could go somewhere abroad to, you know, have some exposure with some research. And so one of his good friends is Dr. Yu. Dr. Sonia Yu, who is a professor of ophthalmology in Bascom-Palmer, specialized in cornea and refractive surgery. So I just, you know, come to Bascom planning to spend 2 months with Dr. Yu to do some research. I don't know what happened, but I've been here now for 9 years. That was a very, very atypical and amazing journey. I started doing research on the clinical side with Dr. Yu, and then she collaborates with our Ophthalmic Biophysics Center, directed by Dr. Jean-Marie Parel, Dr. Fabrice Mans, and Dr. Marco Ruggeri. So it's a biomedical engineering lab. They had like some project in collaboration, basically. And so I ended up, you know, working more and more in the lab to the point to be hired in the lab as a research fellow. And for a few years, I worked closely with Dr. Parel, Dr. Mann, Dr. Ruggeri, and the whole team at the OBC. So mainly on OCT imaging. They have a team really specialized in OCT imaging and accommodation. So not only imaging accommodation to understand it better, but to try to solve presbyopia, basically by creating potential accommodity lens. They've been working on it for a few decades and it's still ongoing. So that was the first project that I worked on. A lot of publication on OCT imaging and accommodation. So my first mentor was here in Miami, was basically Dr. Sonia Yu, an amazing woman in ophthalmology. That was my path and my early days in the path of clinical ophthalmology and research specialized in visual science.
Very cool. Thank you so much, Dr. Kuro. I remember first meeting you through the master's program and you were teaching us how to interpret OCT. That was such a cool experience to learn firsthand from a clinician. I'll kick it off to Dr. Ishpajani.
Thanks, Catherine. So way back in 2004, when I did my post-graduation, I was coming from a healthcare setup that catered to a huge number of underprivileged patients with high efficiency. So clinical research was one of the minor focus points in my residency at that time point. But in India, we have something called a senior residency, which is more like registrarship. And that I did at one of the premier institutes. And it was there and then that I was exposed to various ophthalmic subspecialities. And I chose glaucoma as my area of interest. Usually at most places in India, the fellowship training is about 12 to 18 months. But this residency, senior residency, is a commitment of 36 months of absolutely unadulterated glaucoma training. The chief of ophthalmology at this center, who's renowned globally for his work on intraocular tuberculosis, Professor Mohd Gupta, he emphasized only on one thing, and that is the importance of asking questions. It was a repeated drilling into our heads that once you start asking questions, you then graduate to start asking the right questions. And my mentor here, Dr. Panda, was very interested into healthcare information technology. And he had designed a Linux-based EMR system for the glaucoma service all by himself. So both these men had a major influence in me thinking about research. Now, that research may not be absolutely groundbreaking, but day-to-day issues, I'm thinking of a research question of addressing those issues with smaller tech tools that are available at our hand is something that I thought would be a guiding light for me for my future research projects. So once I moved to the US for my research fellowship with Dr. Spaeth, and then Dr. Marlene Moster was amazing, and she is such a wonderful surgeon. She also sort of drew my interest more towards surgical research questions and to think about how to address some of those issues. So there are multiple people who have influenced me, but I guess what I learned from all of them was to not focus at the result, but think about first asking the right question, formulating a good research question, and then going and taking your baby steps. So that's it for me. Thank you.
Totally. I mean, you mentioned Dr. Pandev and Dr. Gupta being your, you know, initial impetus for tapping into research. And for me, it was really your mentorship, Dr. Ishpajani. You be modest when you say that you answer small questions, but really looking at several devices that you've been able to use for assessment of glaucoma remotely with contrast sensitivity, be it perimetry using tablet devices or even smartphone photography for that matter. So really my stepping stones into the tech side of ophthalmology or research in ophthalmology has really been through your purview. But appreciate that, and I really appreciate you sharing your experience today. With that, Ricky, why don't we kick off the second theme for today?
Thanks, Brandon. I'm glad to do that. Second theme for today is about how you guys navigated your path in life, and what challenges did you face? What rewards did you find along the way as you were tackling these interesting research questions and making innovations in the field? The first question I have along those lines is, do you remember what motivated you initially to pursue innovation and research?
Yeah, so the first thing for me is I didn't think like specifically to do hardcore research in a lab when I came here. I was more on the clinical side. And I really discovered the lab by collaborating with Dr. Yu and Dr. Perel. I realized that actually, because I had finished my residency, so I had some ophthalmic knowledge. And what I realized is there's a big barrier between the lab and the clinic. And it's like the engineers are afraid to cross this barrier or this border, and the clinicians are also afraid, you know, to cross the line and go to the lab. And so I actually became a liaison in between the lab and the clinic. And I had on one side the engineers asking me, like, so, but what do you need in clinic? What do you need? We have the, you know, the tools and the knowledge how to build an OCT, how to build a new lens, how to build a robotized CTAM. Just tell us what you need. And so it was fantastic because then I was walking to Bascom and I say, hey, we have this like engineering team, like they are ready to build whatever we want. Like, how can we improve our, you know, daily clinical activities by new tools? So it's actually this position, this connection, connecting link between the two sides that was extremely interesting to me. And that's why I kept pursuing to have this double side and research side and clinical side. And I spent now, it's going to be 8 years. So 8 years in the lab and in Bascom. And the first thing we started to do, for example, the PDT, so the UV therapy for infectious keratitis, I remember 8 years ago doing the in vitro experiments in the lab. And now I see the machine has been built by the engineers, and the machine is used in clinic on a daily basis, and we're going to go to clinical trials. I saw the entire full circle from the idea, the engineers building the thing, doing the in vitro experiments, and the machine literally brought to clinic and having this such big impact in treating infectious keratitis. So that's this like full cycle I really, really enjoyed. And that's why I want to keep doing that.
So I actually, as an MD PhD, I find that really fascinating that you've gotten to be involved in this process, kind of, you know, the complete process of translation from bench to engineering to bedside application. I am curious, how did you end up finding your way into that? For someone who is interested in playing that kind of role, where do you get started?
So like I said, I was very lucky because in the lab, this like a biomedical engineering lab, they had different projects and they didn't have many people on the clinical side. So for them, I appeared as, oh, wow, we have someone who is accessible, who is not busy with clinic and surgery. And we can ask her like as many questions as we can, and she can help us make our like engineering work relevant for clinic. So that's how it started. And I started to be involved like in different projects, and then you get too busy. And so you have to kind of prioritize one project over the other ones.
Okay, that totally makes sense. So it sounds like as you were present, you were with engineers, you were in the lab, so you were with these people, but then you had the clinical background to serve as that bridge.
Exactly. And we are very lucky in Bascom-Palmer because the engineering lab is the building attached to Bascom-Palmer. So for me, going to the lab and to Bascom, it would take me like 2 minutes. And I know it's not very common to have the two facilities, like the lab and the clinic, so close to each other. And so for sure, if you have to drive to a lab that is 30 minutes away by car, that's not going to be the same relationship. For me, I was having lunch with the engineers one day, having lunch with the clinicians the other day. So the collaboration, we were very close. It was a very close collaboration. And I think it's a very, very special environment, special collaboration here in Bascom-Palmer.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. And I think that we don't think about that enough, the importance of physical proximity and placing people with different backgrounds in touch with each other where they're going to some of the same talks and meetings. But I appreciate your bringing that up and mentioning that. I do want to see if Dr. Shapujani has any thoughts related to the same question. What initially motivated you to pursue research innovation?
I'm not a clinician scientist, as they say today. I've not done a PhD. I am purely a clinician with a scientific mindset. And I attempt to find answers to small, common clinical situations and trying to use tech to it so that it just appeals more to the residents. It's easier for the patient to do. And in cases there is a major failure of the machines that we are really banking on at our work, if they don't function, you have something to fall back to and solve your patient's issues. And unfortunately, Indian residency or fellowships for the longest didn't have any grants. So people were not really too much into research because there was big research meant putting in a lot of money. But now in the past few years, the trend of encouraging research has sort of come in, and we are getting funded from the government. I've recently started a big project with the Center for Development of Advanced Computing in India here, and I'm currently working on a government-funded project on artificial intelligence framework using data analytics for detection of chronic illness from retinal images. So it's been baby steps. There was nothing too planned. And now people have come to realize that it's the teamwork. You really can't do everything alone. And as a clinician, we have to sort of sometimes decide that do we really just want to step into the biomedical aspect of it, or do we want to remain as domain experts? So things are getting better delineated, at least on this side of the world. We're gradually getting to it and stepping out of our comfort zones and learning alongside doing some good work.
Those are some really great thoughts. I agree about the importance of teamwork and collaboration. I think that's been a theme on a lot of the talks we've had on IT here, especially when we all have different background. And I think that goes well with what Dr. Cabot was saying too about being a bridge between people with different types of expertise. The next question I wanted to bring up is, what are some of the challenges and rewards of the various roles that you've taken on in your career path? And I'll let you guys decide what order we want to go with this question.
On a funny note, the first challenge I had is speaking English when I came here. And because I was French, and when I came here, I basically didn't speak English, but it's just for the funny note. The challenges is probably for me with my, I would say, like a special position is to be able to understand what the engineers wanted and what the clinicians wanted. Trying to understand that this like two different worlds that are working at a different pace. That's what I say to the students most of the time. Research is amazing, but if you only have 6 months to write papers, that's going to be very difficult if you go in the lab, because fundamental research or biomedical engineering research, it takes time. And so you need to start early, basically. And it's very frustrating because sometimes as clinicians, we are used to rush and to go fast, which is the opposite with the research side. On the research side, it's more like, let's take our time, let's think about it, are we sure that what we're doing is relevant, etc. So it's like that you need to kind of put together. So initially, that was a little bit difficult to understand for me because I had only this like clinical background. But once you understand it, then things work like much better. And the reward is when you understand how things work, then, as I said earlier, to see this full cycle from the idea coming from the clinician or the engineer, having the engineer doing the first experiments or yourself doing the first experiment and seeing the machine as a full applicable device or tool for a daily clinics, that was probably the most rewarding thing for me.
Thank you so much for sharing, Dr. Cabot. And Dr. Shpujani, did you have some thoughts about challenges and rewards in your career?
Well, in most institutions in India, barring a few purely ophthalmic care centers in South India, and most of us are expected to do most of the clinical work, and we are overstressed performing our routine work of basic patient care itself. Plus, there is no supportive team of research coordinators or a counselor, so most of the work has to be done by the one clinician himself or herself. And that at times can be overwhelming and, you know, push you away from the research bit of it. And that's, I think, one of the major challenges which most of the centers, at least in the developing world where there is no proper infrastructure, they sort of face. Since many studies are not even funded, the dropouts in the studies with longer follow-ups are there. So that sort of sometimes compromises your research because the patients are not compensated for their travel for your study visit. These are some of the logistic challenges which I've faced. I've been lucky to have mentors who have been there at each step of the way to encourage and help me overlook these challenges. When it comes to rewards, some of my med students, including Gagan and many more who are there in the US pursuing their fellowships, they have been drawn to ophthalmology and some others to ophthalmic research because of at least something that I did. And I think that's a big reward in itself, that somewhere I was a part of their journey. I'm currently on the World Glaucoma Association's Education Committee, and that has been a reward to my past efforts. And it's actually helping me to collaborate with many other people from across the globe. and that I really consider as one of my biggest rewards.
Thanks. Yeah, thank you so much. Dr. Shpachani, I want to ask a question following up on one of the things that you were saying. I think the role of mentorship is incredibly important. I guess I just wanted to ask both of you to comment more on the role that mentorship has played in your journey and how you've found ways to mentor others. And for those of us younger in our training, how do we make that transition from being mentored to being a mentor in our own journeys?
We are more first like a friend to our students. And unless we break that ice, there is nothing that's going to come to fruition. So there has to be a free flow of thoughts. A mentor is not supposed to be rigid. And once there is a free flow of thoughts, I guess that really brings out very good ideas. And the younger gen, that's your generation, is so much exposed to technology of every sort that your ideas can definitely add concrete results to a sort of concept that's just formulating. Your mentor can actually take a lot of help from the new mentees. And the free flow of ideas and the camaraderie between the mentor and mentee, I think that's one of the most important foundation stones for a good research to happen. I mean, you don't want to be scared of your mentor, which a good 10, 15 years back, people used to be of their senior mentors. You know, if you goof up, there is always a way to find out and do an alternative thing to it. So that relationship with your mentor, that's really, really important. And openness to thoughts. And if you want to even thrash an idea, even midway of work off having done a project, no harm. We can always pick up something else and do it. So that support from the mentor that even if you make mistakes, even if something has gone majorly wrong, no hell is breaking loose and you can always find an alternative hypothesis, an alternative path. That's what I felt. There was a time when I had a certain fear when I was trying to even put forth an idea. And Dr. Spaeth was the most supportive mentor I could have ever thought of. And I thank my stars that I went to him. And my ideas really opened up and there were things that I did, I learned with him. And that's only because of the free flow of thoughts. So I give a lot of weightage to that.
Thank you so much. I think that's incredibly helpful. I really appreciate the insights there. Dr. Kubot, did you have anything you wanted to add?
Yeah, sure. One thing I learned is actually when you try to find a mentor, so I'm talking about the clinical side, you have all those amazing ophthalmologists, super famous, and you think, oh, they are completely not accessible. Should I email them and et cetera? And so my advice is just go for it. Even if you don't get an answer, it's not a negative thing because you just need to understand that someone who is a full professor, they have clinical duties, surgical duties, administrative duties. And it's not that they don't want to answer your email. It's just they don't have time. And they probably think about your email, you know, every day. That's what happens to me is I have like mentees. And sometimes I feel guilty because I would like, you know, to email them every day and to follow up with them every day. It's just I don't have the time. So my advice for all the trainees is just, you know, pick a mentor, show them that you're motivated, show them you're interested, bring them ideas, and just realize that if they don't answer, it's not because they don't like you, they don't want to work with you, it's just because they are so busy with other duties. And so just keep trying. And if you think about what your mentor expects from you, then that's, you know, perfect. You know, some mentors want to, they're going to give you an idea and you're going to be the soldier bringing this idea to the lab or to a paper, a manuscript. Some other mentors, they are looking for students having ideas. So just try to understand what your mentor wants. And the next step is create a bubble of trust because that's super important. If you create a special bond with your mentor, then they're not going to become like family, but they're going to support you 500%. And I think that's super important to understand. If you start working with like 10 different mentors, you're never going to have this like special bond or special connection. And so you're probably going to get less support than if you just stick to one mentor who's going to know you well. And it's going to, all the tenses on your side when you apply for a residency or fellowship. And so for me, that was the case with Dr. Yu. I worked almost exclusively with her and with the lab. And it's been 9 years, and I still consider her as my mentor. And we have this special relationship. And I think that's why things work so well for me. And everything I got from Dr. Yu, from the lab, from Bascom Palmer, to me, it's almost like mandatory to give it back to the new students and all my mentees. I cannot picture being a clinician without teaching and being involved in education. So this same thing, it's really a full cycle. Bascom gave me so much that I want to do the same and have students who enjoyed the ride as much I did.
I really appreciate all of those great thoughts. I'm going to hand things off to Grayson to tackle theme three for our session today.
Thank you so much, Ricky. And I am just blown away by everything you guys are saying so far. I'm learning a ton, and I'm honored to be able to ask you guys a couple questions. The very first question I have is that you guys are innovating in a big way. Dr. Kabo, you've been working a lot with the drone slit lamp at Bascom and working with, I see Rania Habash in the audience, on telemedicine. And then Dr. Parul, you've been working to write that recent book in AI. Could you give us your perspective on the future of ophthalmology and how you see new tools like this helping improve access for patients through telemedicine and AI over the next 10 years or so? Maybe we can start with you, Dr. Kabo.
Yeah, I think COVID brought this telemedicine at the forefront of medicine, and there's no going back. That's one good thing, at least COVID brought to medicine. I think now we are in the middle of a transition between the old age of ophthalmology and the future. I see it in my clinics. I have regular clinics and I have televisits, like or hybrid visits. And I think we're going to shift completely in the future for sure. So that's the first step. For example, if you think about it, for some other specialties, the patients, they go get an MRI, they go get a CT scan, and then they come back, you know, to the PCP, et cetera, and the PCP or somebody else read the results and tell them what they have. And in ophthalmology, we were used to have all this like imaging platform on site. And I think things are changing. So the patient would come to do their like anterior segment of CT or just images, and then they have like a different appointment with the doctor. That's what we call in Bascom the hybrid visits. So it's getting more and more popular. It's something, it's just the beginning of a new era. And the second step, and I think Dr. Perl is going to be probably better explaining that, but the AI is going to help in diagnosing some disease and going to help giving access to eye care in rural areas or deserted areas by like screening a patient without the need of a physical doctor on site. That's my idea of what the future of ophthalmology is going.
Thank you, Dr. Kabo. Very, very telling. I agree with everything you said in terms of the hybrid visits and in terms of the technology's capabilities for improving access. And Dr. Parul, I'd love to hear from you as well.
Well, I agree with her that COVID has really fractured our infrastructure. It's going to bring in new tools to the smart devices and teleophthalmology. And I guess it's time we all recognize that this something or the other is going to keep coming up in the years to come. This pandemic has made us know the fact that we need to strengthen our teleophthalmology. A lot of tests earlier were just based upon the physical visit of the patient. But now with newer apps and newer tools, you can just take a visual field test sitting at your home. You have a Melbourne Rapid Field Toolkit. You can do a macular visual field testing or a glaucoma or a neuro-ophthalmology visual field testing just on your iPad sitting at home. Your doctor will just send you a link and you can do it. You can do a contrast sensitivity test using Spaeth Richmond contrast sensitivity free online tool. And you get information both for peripheral and central contrast. All these data are then sent an email to your physician. Sitting at home, you can just provide the relevant info to your doctor and they can just triage if you're progressing. Do they want to call you to the clinic or are you safe at your home and continue the medication that you were putting? So with that coming in and with the AI, things are definitely going to look much better. And we'll, I think, be much better prepared for people in scenarios of epidemics and pandemics when other diseases take a back seat. These teleophthalmic platforms will definitely come to help the other patients. That's the way to go. And I hope that happens really soon and we are better prepared for the future.
We were certainly tossed into a unique situation with COVID, especially with ophthalmology where we're so testing heavy. And you two, well before COVID, started to think about innovations that might be applicable to this. Now, a lot of other people are jumping on and trying to help solve these problems too. I'd just love to hear from each of you about your process of innovating, the process of thinking of new solutions and trying to tackle the old paradigms, because you guys are well ahead of your time. And Dr. Perul, we can start with you. What's your process of innovation?
I'm not a clinician scientist. What I do is actually happening not in a lab, but with in front of me at my clinic most of the times. And that gives me an idea as to how to take care of the problem. And one of the busy days in my OPD, I was just sitting and following up my post-trabeculectomy patients, and our anterior segment division system hit a snag. And Gagan was posted with me at that time, and I wanted to document my trabeculectomy bleb. So we used a smartphone to image the bleb. Once we captured the images, we thought, why not look at it whether a single camera smartphone works better or a dual camera works better. That led to another set of images from different patients. Then we moved on to look at, to explore whether we want to vary contrast or brightness or magnification and whatnot. And that came out as a paper. That was a small technical thing that I wanted to do, but that gave a research idea. Similarly, I was working with Dr. Spaeth on a book for patient care of glaucoma patients. And we were talking about what patients with glaucoma usually see. And most patients, they reported not the constriction of visual fields, but difficulty in contrast. And that made us think about evaluating contrast. And since it's the periphery which is getting knocked off, why are we ignoring peripheral contrast? So he developed the tool and I worked on it on many, many subjects. And I went beyond exploring the just glaucoma related contrast sensitivity issues to now I'm using the tool for exploring contrast deterioration in patients who are on hydroxychloroquines or who are on anti-tuberculosis therapy. One idea leads to another. You need to show interest in the number of patients initially can be small, but once you have good results, it gives you a boost and you expand your data set. So it's the usual clinical problems at times that pave way for good, sound research. And I'm very happy that in this day and age, we are having so many research tools and so many tech tools at our disposal that make our life so easy.
Seeing the problems in front of you is definitely one way to go. And it's probably the best way. Solve a problem that's real, that you're tangibly seeing. It sounds like you and Gagan helped figure that out in real time with the imaging. But Dr. Cabot, what about you? What's your process of identifying problems and innovating to find a new solution?
I completely agree. The initial step is really a clinical need. Every great idea comes from something we are lacking and something we are trying to solve. If I take the example of the drone seat lamp, I can explain to you actually why we call it the drone seat lamp, which sound a little bit weird. It's actually the Department of Defense who had a clinical need of ophthalmologists on site in the battlefield because they don't have many ophthalmologists in the military. So when soldiers were injured, they didn't have anybody to assess and tell, okay, this soldier needs to go back home because he needs surgery, or, oh no, it's just like a subconscious hemorrhage, he can stay on site. So the Department of Defense basically asked the biomedical engineering lab if we could build a seat lamp that they could actually parachute on the battlefield and have someone in the US guiding remotely this seat lamp to assess any potential injury in a soldier and determine if the soldier needed to go back home for surgery. This need, that was the first step in starting the process of building this drone seat lamp. And we still call it drone seat lamp because initially it was supposed to be you fly the seat lamp on the battlefield and then you operate it remotely to help the soldiers. And we just kept the name all along, even though now we're not planning on flying the seed lamps. That's basically a clinical need, something that is lacking that created this idea, and it's how all these things started 10 years ago. That's what I was saying earlier. It takes time. And this idea kept improving the drone seed lamp over the years. And then the pandemic hit last year, and then suddenly everybody had the need to have like a remote exam. And so we suddenly, last year, we had emails, phone calls from everybody, hospitals, companies, asking us, hey, I saw this at drone seed lamp one day, 5 years ago at the Orvo meeting. Is it available? Can we buy it? Can we buy it? And so, again, that was a clinical need that created this second big wave, a big step that pushed us to, you know, move the project much faster.
Amazing. Really solving problems that people have identified or you identify yourself seems to be a theme. And for all the young trainees or early career physicians in the room, I'd love to hear your thoughts on any skills that you think that we should be focused on in order to tune our perception or our minds to be ready to tackle these problems when we recognize that something needs to be innovated.
So I keep saying that, but you need to keep in mind if your idea is more on the research side or more on the clinical side, or if it's a translational thing. If it's a translational thing, for sure, things are going to go faster. You have two different worlds working at two different pace. So it's something to keep in mind. So start early. If you have an idea, find a mentor, find someone who knows, because when you have a great idea, it's nice. Everybody has great idea, but to bring a great idea to the market or to the clinical side, that's a different story. It can take time. It can take a lot of things. And one of the challenges is going to be the money. So to find grants, etc. So usually when you're like a trainee, you don't know much about that. So ask, you know, your mentors, what grants can I get, can I apply for to actually, you know, build something around the idea I have. And it's something we are not really trained for that in medical school, how to navigate those like the grant applications. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is if you think your idea can go to like to be commercialized, that's also a different path that we don't really talk about. And we have at the university, and I'm sure in every university, you have some transfer technology like departments. So very early on, if you really have something in mind and you think it can be commercialized, you should talk to this department transfer technology. They can help you to patent your idea, to work with you, because it's not because you have your idea that everything is going to belong to you, is going to be able to bring it to the market. It's a long, long process and a lot of people involved. So it's something yet to consider when you start.
Amazing. I totally agree. The resources available at our institutions to talk about patenting and getting things licensed out is really valuable to explore early on if you have a new idea. And Dr. Perul, how about yourself? What kind of skills should young trainees and early career ophthalmologists be thinking about working on to make sure that we're ready to tackle innovation?
I guess every student is a researcher. Some recognize it sooner than others, and others have to be nudged a bit to recognize the trait of theirs. I absolutely agree with Dr. Florence to just feel totally armed and find an appropriate mentor to go ahead with their research ideas. But before they get into the field, I guess a good amount of knowledge for the basic biomedical research tools and including statistics is really, really important. And grant writing, of course, in this time and age, there's nothing which will work without money. So grant writing skills are really, really important. And you just have to take the first step.
Well, thank you both. I can't thank you enough for providing your insights.
Dr. Ispachani, Dr. Kapoor, we really appreciate your time.
Thank you for the invitation. That was great.
Thank you, everybody. Enjoy.
If you want more IT-related content, follow us on Instagram and Twitter. Also, find us on Spotify or wherever you get your podcast. Search for E by E T E A I T.